Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, President Mark Udoff, new president of the University of California. Please welcome Mark Udoff tonight.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you, Diana. I was pleased with the brief introduction, and I'll try not to go over tonight. People always tell me that I'm someone who's not only dull myself, but bring out dullness in other people, so I'll try not to do that. I wanted to thank you for the kind invitation to be here tonight, and I'm looking forward to Father Privet's questions that you'll submit to him, and I'll do my best to try to answer. Usually when I begin a talk, I like to begin with the good news, but I think if I did that, we'd all be thinking about the elephant in the room. Let's state what we know to be true, and that is that California and our nation are undergoing tremendous economic upheaval. Jobs are threatened or lost. The 401ks many people count on for their retirement are dissipating. Many parents are asking themselves whether to pay for health care or for groceries. These are very difficult times, and virtually no one is immune. Let me tell you a little bit about where things stand in my current institution, the University of California. And I've discovered many of these things recently. We have with us Dick Blum tonight, the chairman of the board, and he didn't tell me about any of this stuff when he hired me. I just want to make that clear. We are, by my count, underfunded by nearly $1 billion. And I figure I've only been in office 5 months, so at this rate we're in deep doo-doo $1 billion deficit and not even a full year. We get funding from a lot of sources, the federal government funds, research grants, and some student financial aid. Our teaching hospitals bring in their own revenues. But the core funding for academic programs comes from the state of California and from student fees. And what has happened in California is that the state share has declined while the student share has grown. Just since 1990, adjusting for inflation and enrollment growth, the per student spending or funding for education at the University of California has fallen nearly 40%. 40% over a bit less than a 20-year period. Meanwhile, the student contribution, which is paid through student fees, has doubled over that same period of time. What has happened is not a dramatic increase in the cost of running a university. Many people don't understand this. Operational costs in higher education have been rising roughly at the rate of inflation, maybe a percentage point higher. What has happened is that the decline in the state funding contribution has led to a corresponding increase in the price for students. If you want an analogy from your life, it's like the copay when you go to have a prescription filled at the local pharmacist. Your copay may have doubled. The cost of the drug may not have gone up at all, or may have gone up marginally. The cost to the consumer has gone up, but the cost of producing the drug has not necessarily gone up, and that is the case in higher education. Today, in the current fiscal year, we're facing cuts of about $113 million, and that is real cut. That's a real cut. That is $113 million less this year than last, assuming that the governor's proposal for mid-year cut is enacted by the legislature. And we're looking at another $100 million that we have to use to pay from existing resources for other bills that come due, like rising energy costs, some rising personnel costs, increased cost of library books, and so forth. So $113 million in direct cuts, another $100 million to be absorbed out of existing budgets. with potentially more cuts to come along the way. So what does it mean in real terms? My fear is that continuing state budget cuts will threaten access, quality, and affordability at the University of California. Budget cuts bring a risk of what I call silent cuts. I call them silent cuts because they're almost invisible to the larger community off campus, and they rarely get reported in the newspapers. Such cuts include things like hiring more lecturers instead of engaging in searches for tenured and tenure-track faculty, such things as allowing class sizes to grow, such things as having fewer sections of introductory courses, so it might take a student longer to graduate, such as limiting library hours and other student services and so on down the line. Now, we're going to try very hard to avoid those types of things, and we're working through a process to look very carefully at the budgets, but given the fact the instructional budget is such a large proportion of our expenditures, it's very difficult and it's certainly impossible to absolutely promise that the instructional budget will be unscathed as we go through this year. And by the way, one of my fears is I don't see this getting better. What about next year? What about the year after? And I'm concerned about alternative sources of revenue. Philanthropy, we all suspect, will be way down. And the number of patents and intellectual property we transfer may well be down. It's not a good time overall. And it's not a good time for student fees. This is a difficult time for families to contemplate paying for more for a college education. My own view is the closer to zero the fees are, the better I feel about it, the happier I am about it. But we have a problem, and that is universities are moving. It's a motion picture, and we can't have a freeze frame and say that if we absorb cuts and fees don't go up, that the university will be the same university you enrolled in 1, 2, 3, and 4 years ago. It probably won't be the same. We will lose professors to other institutions. We will have fewer people to package the aid packages. We'll have fewer people to deliver the services and the like. So we're always trying to balance the diminution in quality against the real impact that fee increases have on our students. Now, one thing I've observed about this is many things in America have not, some things, maybe not many, have gotten less expensive over time. You know, we manufacture TV, there's manufacturing of TVs and clothing, and what is similar about them is they've gone offshore and they become more competitive. My daughter took me to Old Navy. I didn't understand it. She said I wasn't cool. I always thought I was cool. And I was amazed that some of the shirt prices were not different than what I paid in the 70s and 80s. But there's a difference between two of our real problems in America and the shirts that I'm describing and some of our electronic goods. That is, by and large, healthcare and higher education will not go offshore. They're domestically produced. And by and large, these other types of enterprises have. So I think that if we continue the present model, we're probably in for a very difficult period. That is, it's a labor-intensive model. It depends upon a professor and a modest-sized class. It depends on being able to supervise writing and 1,000 other things, all of which I would argue work very well. But we may be forced over the next 10 or 20 years to take another look at the use of technologies in higher education, because it may not be possible to stick with the model that we have pursued, I would argue, very successfully over so many years. So what are we to do? One thing all families do in times like this is to reexamine their budgets, and we're doing that. We've been downsizing the office of the president in Oakland, and since we began, we've reduced the budget there by about $60 million and 500 employees. Much of this predates me. Our campuses are also tightening their budgets in all kinds of areas, ranging from travel to purchasing to business systems. We've also have made sure we have robust financial aid programs so that the students of limited means are protected from fee increases to the greatest extent possible. A third of all the fee increases is immediately plowed back into financial aid for the students, and it's modulated by income level, so the poorest students get the most financial aid. But even in these challenging financial times, we also must continue laying the groundwork for the state's eventual economic recovery. And in my judgment, higher education is critical to that recovery. Ultimately, we need to be talking about investing in higher education and our state's human capital once again. And that's what I'd like to focus on briefly tonight. Part of what we need to do more effectively in higher education, I believe, is to tell our story. I think it's widely known that the University of California provides an excellent education. Many people have firsthand experience with the high-quality health care that is provided, and even the economic impact and job creation that come out of the University of California's research is fairly well known. It is not well known that public higher education contributes to the lives of nearly all Californians, irrespective of whether you have a son or daughter at one of our institutions or whether a family member is employed on one of those campuses. There are hundreds of examples of that, and let me just give you a few of them. The highway bridges we drive on are more resistant to earthquakes because of University of California research. Everyday devices like the CD player and the barcode scanner have their roots in UC research. You may have mixed feelings about the barcode, but there it is. Faculty at the University of California have developed better flame retardant gear for firefighters. Smaller solar cells to enhance the energy efficiency of buildings have been developed. Devices that kidney disease sufferers can wear to liberate them from dialysis machines were developed at the University of California. Researchers at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab are developing a much more powerful automobile battery that could make us, as a state and as a nation, much less dependent on fossil fuels, obviously one of the great challenges of our time. And the list goes on and on. And if you like strawberries, I'll almost guarantee they were developed at the University of California, Davis. Ruby red grapefruits at Texas A&M University, a little iffier proposition. So if you're talking about workforce development or advances in human health or new products to drive our economy and enhance our quality of life, you're talking about the work of higher education, but talk is not enough. We in higher education need to prove to the people of California and to their elected officials that the true value of their investment in higher education is very high and that it is very important. And this is one of the things that I've tried to stress. There is a higher authority, I know it's hard to imagine in California, than the California legislature. And that higher authority is the people of California. And if we can make them aware and persuade them of these needs, perhaps the more will happen. You know, there's a saying, Chairman Blum is tired of me saying, that about university presidents, and this particularly applies to President of the University of California. Remember, it's not a university at 12th and Broadway in Oakland. It's sort of an ethereal existence, a university without faculty, without students, without prize winners, without blackboards, without progress in many forms, actually. But university presidents are like groundskeepers at cemeteries. There are a lot of people under you, but almost no one is listening. But I, having said that, I have been pleased as president with some of the responses I've gotten. And the first thing I think it's important, if you want to make your needs clearly known, is to provide for greater transparency and accountability in our operations. I believe that we should be held accountable by parents, by students, by taxpayers, by employees, by our students, by the legislature. If someone asked, did you have a good year at Berkeley, or asked about a specific research program, or asked about diversity, or asked about new technology, whether it's worth the cost and what are you getting out of it, I think we ought to be able to give an honest answer backed up by empirical data, and that is my view. My motto, which I know that I plagiarized from someone, in God we trust, all others bring data. And that's the maxim that summarizes this approach. And I think, fortunately, the Board of Regents and the faculty, and we have some, at least one faculty representative here, have bought into that. And now we're producing an annual accountability report. It's still in draft form. It has 102 measures. It's not perfect, but it talks about affordability, research, faculty quality, diversity. university finance and other things. It's online, and it's undergoing public review and will be revised for final submission by the end of the year. And over time, it will, I hope, improve and will identify more variables and try to answer the questions I've talked about. Now, I'm the first to admit that not everything at a university can be measured quantitatively. If a student is turned on to poetry, or a student becomes a great student of the arts, it may not be easily measured. And those are important outcomes, and we have to be careful that we leave a lot of room for those types of aesthetic qualities. So we can't overemphasize the number. But in my experience, just because you can't measure everything doesn't mean you shouldn't measure anything. And there are areas of university life where we can measure. We can determine what our graduation rates are. We can figure out whether we're admitting enough students, transfer students from community colleges. And we can figure out whether they're going on to graduate schools or to good jobs. There are many things that we can measure, and we ought to do it. And that accountability, I think, is helpful in a number of ways. It's important in terms of justifying ourselves to those who fund us and to the parents and to the families. It's also important because it helps us manage better. We know where we're coming up short, and that's a very important thing to do. Having said all that, I think California needs to pay greater attention to its investment in human capital. We fund infrastructure through public funds in this state and across the country. We fund prisons. We fund a lot of things with public money. But our investment in human capital development has the greatest impact on the growth potential of our society. 50 years ago, Californians knew that. Governor Pat Brown and the great UC president, Clark Kerr, knew that human capital would change the future of California. They put together a master plan for higher education that provided for universal access to higher education in California and access to high-quality education. They realized that all these young minds in the baby boom generation, if given the right tools, would become the knowledge infrastructure that would allow California to thrive in a way that no other state in the country, indeed no other place in the world, had thrived. And look at California today, or perhaps look at California a year ago would be a better case. We have the 8th largest economy in the world. We're the birthplace of entire industries like biotechnology. There have been more Nobel laureates in California than in any other place in the world, 54 of them. I keep checking the list. I thought my letter may have gone awry, but I'm not on it for the Nobel. We can also look beyond our shores to understand what truly has been created here in California. Earlier this year, I was invited to give a talk to the new King Abdullah University in Saudi Arabia. I'm a Jewish guy, and to say I was surprised is to put it mildly. But I went, and I learned a lot. Saudi Arabia is investing $10 billion to create a major research university to build it in 2 years. And when I met with the oil minister, he said to me, Mark, knowledge is the oil of the 21st century. You know, we will eventually run out of oil, but if we have the knowledge base, the creativity, the entrepreneurship, the research, all will be well. After we had discussed this for a while, I can't say a few drinks because that's not the way it works in Saudi Arabia, the education minister finally turned to me and said, you know, on reflection, it's better to have knowledge and oil. And I concurred with that, with that statement, better to have both. Other nations around the world are behaving just like the Saudis. South Korea, Singapore, China, they're all building knowledge-based economies and are looking to the United States for their higher education models. And, of course, the most successful model in America, and I would say in the world, is the University of California. And it is incredibly ironic to me, incredibly ironic, that as our system of higher education is being emulated around the world, when they send teams of people to find out how the University of California did it, when they send their students to our universities to learn engineering and mathematics and computer science and everything else, demography and social sciences and medicine and so forth, it's incredible to me that higher education is fraying here at the home of the model that is the envy of the world. And they're not fooling around. They're not concerned about state governments and provincial governments and national governments. It is national policy in those countries to try to create a structure, and it will be very difficult for them because the physical infrastructure is not everything. But they are trying desperately to emulate the model that really started at the University of California. And I think that fraying is critical because as that commitment frays, it will be very difficult for us to continue on the path that historically we've been on in terms of the economy and to produce the generations of creative young people who will add to economic productivity. We need to keep the doors of college open to students from every background and ethnicity so they can develop their own potential, and it's good for them, it's good for their families, it's good for California, and it's good for the nation. So I believe it's time for all of us, the citizens, elected officials, our own institutions of higher education, to focus in a committed way on investing in our human capital development, our future. And by the way, I don't think it's just within California. I believe that there is an important role for the federal government to play. The huge challenges we are seeing in public higher education in California are being replicated in every state across the nation, the flagging commitment to the great public research universities. There are some leaders in politics and higher education today who think that they can ignore that reality. But the reality is this: the funding model for higher education is broken. It is broken, and it has been broken for more than 30 years. It's just becoming more obvious by the day. And for those who don't want to face it, what I would say is that old adage, denial is not just a river in Egypt. We can't ignore it. One place I'd suggest we have more conversations is in Washington, where there's a great deal of discussion right now about strengthening the economy by investing in physical infrastructure in the states, highways, bridges, public works, and the like. I believe that we should also be looking at capital investments by the federal government in the infrastructure of our public universities. Doing this would create jobs for people who help to build those buildings. It would also have the benefit of improving educational opportunities for generations of students. It would help us foster a competitive workforce and reducing the strain on university budgets by reducing the debt service on our facilities, which is an enormous problem. And I realize this initiative probably would redefine the federal role in higher education. With few exceptions, the federal role basically is paying for sponsored research, National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, Department of Agriculture, Department of Defense, National Endowment for the Arts, and so forth. The provision of student financial aid, which is very important, access issues, Pell Grants, Stafford Loans, and the like. And then the funding of other programs to improve college access along the same lines, some of the interventions in public high schools. These are all very important roles for the federal government. Today, in the area of facilities, we have a practice of earmarks in Congress for particular facilities projects. This is very, very bad public policy. It's political in nature, it's episodic in nature, and the buildings often get built where they really can't be utilized because it really depends on who chairs what committee. We need to create a fairly administered program at the federal level for helping universities to construct the academic and scientific facilities, not as a bailout, but because this is the kind of investment which, frankly, is critical to our national competitiveness and ultimately to our national security. Now, I'll be talking about these ideas in the coming weeks, and these are complex. And remember, it was Clark Kerr who first warned us about taking money from the federal government and all the strings that could be attached to it. But I think we really need to think about reconceptualizing the federal role. Let me close by saying I'm pleased to be here tonight. I'm pleased to be in California. I'm getting used to being shaken and stirred late at night by the occasional earthquake. I did have a great life in Texas till Regent Blum interfered with it. I had good access to Tex-Mex. I had a tenure at the law school. But I really could not pass up the opportunity. And the opportunity, despite all the forewarning that I've talked about tonight, is that the University of California is and remains the world's greatest public university with incredible people resources and student resources and physical resources. We have in the University of California, one of the things that works well, and I hope everyone takes pride in this institution. Now it's our job to sustain it. We're going to do our part by proving our value, and we're going to look to Californians like all of you to help sustain that dream of a half century ago. Thank you again for inviting me here tonight, and I will be open to questions. Thank you.
Our thanks to Mark Udoff, President of the University of California, for his remarks this evening. I'm Father Stephen Privet, President of the University of San Francisco, not to be confused with the University of California at San Francisco, and a member of the Commonwealth's Board of Governors, and I will be moderating tonight's audience question period. So President Udoff, we have a number of questions for you, so let us begin. The largest single set of questions are regarding service workers at the University of the University of California system, and the questions range everything from how do you define accountability to employees of a university, particularly those at the lowest end of the pay scale, to the contrast with those at the low end, with those at the high end. The disclosure today that salaries for the presidents of public universities increased 7.6% in the last year.
At the University of California.
There's a whole convergence for you to deal with.
Welcome to my friends in the first row. I've seen many of you before. let me just say a few things about that. We do have some very significant concerns on behalf of our service employees, and before that, the patient care employees. We've settled with the patient care unions this is a difficult problem. I can't go through all of it tonight, but they are very important to the way our campuses operate. Their pay is not very good. I mean, I concede that. I got a call, and I sort of said, you know, the sooner it was at $20 an hour, the happier I would be, and it still wouldn't be enough for $3 gasoline and all the other issues that you face. We're negotiating. I mean, really, the problem is we've now raised the offer, I think, three times. It's not where Ask Me, which is the union that represents this group, where they would like it to be. We're continuing to negotiate. We now have at the instigation of the chairman and some others, we now have a mediator who is from the union side, and we're working with the mediator. They have a real affordability problem in their families and how to deal with health care and all the other expenses. We have a problem with the absolute magnitude of the amount in the contract. I'm not going to get into all the other issues. I do think they do deserve to be compensated appropriately. I mean, we do live in a world of markets. It's not all going to be even. I mean, that's just the truth of it. We'll work hard to try to reach a conclusion with the union. It is a big ticket item. I'm not going to focus just on the service workers, but broadly, if we gave a 5% raise across the board, it would cost the university $400 million a year, and we're already down over $200 million. So, I mean, there's a fiscal side of this, and we have to balance the budget. It's not an excuse, but it is a partial explanation.
Thank you. Let me link these two questions. One is with regard to what is UC doing to promote women majoring in computer science, I would guess science generally. But coupled with that is an issue with the current emphasis on science and technology. What is UC doing to promote the role of the humanities in undergraduate education?
Well, these things, I sit there in Oakland, and these primarily are dealt with at the campus. But we had a series of diversity reports, which are now being implemented by the provost office, making recommendations as to how to improve diversity, including gender, but not limited to gender, in science and technology, but also in the humanities and other areas, although the representation of women tends to be lower in the scientific and engineering field, so that's a particular area of focus. So we're pushing the program from Oakland, and then we're also pushing the campuses. We're trying our very best to protect the humanities and the social sciences. I mean, part of the problem in the current world we live in is that the amount of external support that engineering programs and science programs and so forth is immense compared to the amount of external support that the humanities receive. So it's a very difficult job. I mean, you know, when you get large sponsored research and their indirect federal costs, there's so much more money that's being put on the science, technology, engineering side from outside. Internally, the allocations, I think, are pretty fair, that we try to keep those programs in the humanities and social sciences, the arts, as strong as we possibly can. But basically, those things are run on the campus.
On a system level, does the University of California system take on any responsibility to ensure that graduates find jobs? Are there placement programs, or are those campus-specific?
Yeah, the truth is, it really wouldn't work very well. I mean, there I am at 12th and Broadway, you know, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, where to go for lunch. You know, I do take a lunch break, and you know, for me to say now, you know, to help someone who's at UCLA to try to find the job, I mean, it works decentralized. We're a very federalist system. You know, there are certain functions that are performed at the center, but activities like that, I mean, really have to be performed in the local market. The accountability report will get into that. I believe in holding people accountable. So eventually I hope to have that data so I can raise it with the chancellors and others, just like on diversity. I can't make those admissions decisions one at a time, but I am entitled to say, why is it that, you know, the number of African-American students or women in science programs or whatever, you know, why is this flattened out? Why is this plateauing? Why is it going down? And what are you going to do about it?
Still at the undergraduate level, there's a concern or questions around what UC is doing to bridge the socioeconomic gap to ensure access for low-income students. And then there's a kind of a counter comment that some people feel that the university, that education was taken away because of affirmative action and that high-quality students are not able to enter the university.
I think in Texas you just say, I'm okay with that issue, and then you go on to the next question. No.
You can try that.
Well, I don't think either of those things is particularly... let me start with the access issue. I think we've done a remarkably good job at the University of California for the low-income students. A third of our students are eligible for Pell Grants, and that means you make under roughly $45,000 a year. I'd like it to be higher. I really believe in it being higher education being a sort of, you know, ladder, a socioeconomic ladder to make your way in the world. But, boy, when you compare that with the Ivies, I mean it's twice many of the Ivies have in terms of low-income students. So I have some other things I'm thinking about, but we already do a credible job, but I'd like to do a little bit better in terms of socioeconomic access. On the other hand, and I'll just say, be honest about it, you know, I didn't vote for 209. If I had been here, I would not have voted to limit affirmative action. I think it's a very useful tool to recruit students, probably, you know, a third or more of you disagree with that, but that's my view. But we are going to obey 209 because it is the law of the land. I'm a Philadelphia lawyer. I read the fine print. I try to obey it when I understand it. So if you look at our past history and the current faculty proposal on eligibility and admissions requirements, you know, they're very high. And we're getting terrific students of color. I mean, I just don't think this is a real something you need to worry about. I mean, I understand that not everyone who wishes to go to the University of California gets a ticket of admission, but we're doing great on quality, and I would like to see the diversity tick upward and the socioeconomic diversity.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. where Mark Udoff, new president of the University of California, is discussing the challenges facing higher education. There were several questions about whether cooperation amongst the three higher ed segments in the state of California are going to be enhanced by the budgetary crisis. Can UC, CSU, and the community college systems working together respond more
adequately? This is the why can't we all get along question.
That's it.
Okay, I've heard that one, yeah. I think that's a pretty high priority. You know, when we had our first draft of our new eligibility proposal, I sent it to Chancellor Reed, University of California, a very early draft, got his comments back. I thought he was very sound. He liked it. I think there are a number of things that we can do, and let me tick off a couple. One is in the area of what are called STEM initiatives, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I think there's a real possibility that we will pool resources to improve high school education in those areas. And that will be with the community colleges and Cal State University. I also have already met with some community college leaders. It's very high on my agenda. If we took more transfer students from community colleges, it has many good effects. One is community colleges cost less money, so the students spend less money to get a four-year degree. Community colleges are also more diverse than the University of California, so there are more Hispanic students, there are more African-American students, and so forth. It also turns out that they do just about as well as first-time freshmen. They're not slacking in any way in their performance as students. So we will be meeting, and probably there'll be a task force with the community colleges and the Cal State people to push along to push it along, because our transfer students have been relatively flat for 4 or 5 years. I'd like to see them inch upward. And there is one last thing, and that is the community colleges tend to be closer to home, so it's less of a transition for the student if they can go to a local institution.
Could you elaborate a bit on what UC is doing to improve the K-12 system in the state of California?
Well, this is a big concern of mine, and it's an area where I used to write books and articles when I made a respectable living. I think we have to be careful because we can't solve all of the state's problems. I'm reviewing. We have 31 programs now, and some of them I frankly think are a mile wide and a half inch deep, and someone issued a press release and it was over and nothing happened. Some of them are really quite good, like the Math and Science Initiative, a special program to train math and science teachers who aren't education school majors but come out of natural sciences and hard sciences, mathematics, and then to place them in high schools and have them mentored by master teachers from the high school. So we're going to be trying to identify a couple of sort of rifle shots where we think we can make a difference. Jack O'Connell was in today, the superintendent, statewide superintendent. We talked about math and science, and we also talked about an algebra initiative to train algebra teachers and to develop curriculum that might actually work better for low-income kids in particular. So we'll be looking at a number of them. We also have other programs. We have Gear Up and Mesa. There are a number of interventions directly in the high schools. So there's a fair amount going on, but I'm almost afraid there's too much. I'd rather focus on just a few things that work well than reel off 30 programs, and I don't really have confidence in 10 of them. So.
There are a number of questions about reducing the cost of delivering a college education, whether or not technology, does classroom and teacher have to be the paradigm? Are there more creative ways to deliver a quality education than the current model, which is?
Well, there probably are. I just haven't thought of them. I think the faculty is going to be getting into this soon because I think we're just on this collision course, and none of us likes it because we're not really unhappy with the results that we have. It's probable, given this generation of students, there will be more reliance on technology, distance learning perhaps, internet-based programs. But, you know, we really haven't reached the point as a society where someone says, here are your choices, Johnny. You can go to Cal State, Fresno, or go to your room for 4 years. You know, people do expect that sort of hands-on type of thing, but I think we may be forced into it over time if we don't fix the financial model. I've done some experiments over my life, and there are areas, like I remember teaching introductory Spanish, and we did a control group experiment and found that a technology-intensive introductory Spanish course actually worked about this as well as a more hands-on meet 4 or 5 days a week with one instructor. So there may be areas where this will occur, but this is a cultural thing. This is not a financial thing, and it's not a technological problem. It's really cultural, and I think it will change, but frankly, I don't know the direction. There's one other area it might go in, and that is kids seem to enjoy games much more than they enjoy calculus. It's just an observation I've made. And it may be, and I've thought about this, that people who invent these games know something about how to entice students that we haven't quite figured out in the academy. So I think that may be a fruitful area to explore, the faculty, curriculum development people with really gaming experts.
There's an observation that in 1997, 43% of the employees in secondary education were not involved in instruction, were non-faculty. Do you have any idea what the comparable statistic would be in the UC system? How many are faculty? What percentage?
Well, I don't know the exact percentage today, but let me explain something. When people think about universities, they're thinking of Peter O'Toole and Mr. Chips in the movies, right? And you're in one business, you educate the undergraduates, and that's all there is to it. It's really not true. We're in multiple businesses, and I will answer the question. I'm just warming up to it. And so do we count the floor nurses at UCSF? Do we count the nutritionalists? Do we count the people who take the x-rays? In research, you know, you get a $50 million grant from the federal government, and you hire people to maintain the equipment, and you hire people to run the experiments, and you put more graduate students on the payroll. Do you count them? Well, of course we count them in our head count. So you have to be very careful. It's not like 43% of the total is sort of hanging around outside the classroom doing nothing while Professor Snodgrass is teaching introductory economics. The fact is that when you're in these multiple businesses, and some of them dwarf, the state appropriation is $3 billion. The amount of research we do is well over four, near $5 billion. It's darn near double what the state appropriation is. And how hospital revenues, paying physicians and paying for their diagnostic tests for patients and hospital stays. So you have to be very careful with those numbers. That's what I'm saying. And in many ways, a university not providing as many services might say, well, we only have 19% who aren't in the instructional program, but that doesn't tell you the whole story.
There are a number of questions regarding principles, priorities set when you're in a budget-cutting mode. So how do you prioritize within the multiple services, departments, campuses, technology, student services, et cetera, when you're looking to reduce costs?
Well, your first priority is to preserve the instructional program. I mean, that's just my view. And we should look, we should not look with favor on cuts that diminish that program. That is our first obligation to the people who pay the bills in California. And that comes absolutely first. If you're looking at the office of the president, my first question is not whether we should cut everyone 5% or 10% or 12%, but what is it you do, and is it a value, or are you part of the problem? Are you adding obstacles to the campuses? So I would say that the principle is one of value added in the office of the president. What do you do in that office that facilitates the work that goes on campuses? And if all you're doing is adding red tape and another level of decision-making without better outcomes, then why are you doing it? So in that theory, some offices should be abolished, other offices should be expanded, and the like. On the campuses, I'm getting into this budget process. You need a process on campus, and this is very hard in higher education. You know, I always say higher education is like a grand museum without a deacquisition policy. And things accrete over time. They just grow and grow and grow, and no one knocks anything out. The campuses are going to have to dig in and say, you know, this program no longer makes sense. We live in the age of computers. Maybe we shouldn't have a vacuum tube department. This doesn't seem to make as much sense as it did in 1920. Then you have to look to see whether some operations can be combined. And remember that the bulk of our expenditures do not come from state funds or even state funds and fees. So they have these funny rules in Washington. If you get money to do research on laser beams and you give it to the Chaucer group in the English department, you go to jail. And so, you know, we have an interest in the laser beam group being as accurate as possible and as and the administrative costs being low. But that's one of the big problems in higher education. It's not as easy to move around money as you would think because a lot of this is spoken for. When you come to one of our hospitals and they say, we're going to do a chest x-ray and you pay us, and then they say, well, we're not going to take the chest x-ray because really they're having a terrible time in fine arts on the Davis campus, you know, that's just not going to wash. So that's our issue. So we can be rich in some pots and not so rich in other pots.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, where Mark Udoff, new president of the University of California, is discussing the challenges facing higher education. Is UC going to limit, decrease, or increase freshman admissions for next year?
This is where I take the Fifth Amendment. The truth is no decision has been made on that, and it is unsustainable. We are now 10,000 students over what the legislature has funded us for. So it is not sustainable that we will continually add thousands and thousands of students every year, and the state simply does not put any more money because it has implications for the quality. On the other hand, I really don't like the idea of limiting opportunities, and I would be reluctant to do that. So we're actually analyzing this for the Board of Regents, and you know probably you know in the next month or two we have to make a decision fairly soon. We'll bring it back to the board, but there are no good choices. The last thing in the world I really want is some legislator to say, "I told you so." You really didn't need the money. You absorbed 5,000 students. Everything was peachy keen. And that's a problem, but limiting opportunity is a problem, too. I think I weaseled on that one, but that's where I am today.
I think you weaseled nicely. Now I'm going to give you one. This may be an indefensible, but a number of people are expressing dismay at your red tie during the week of the big game.
Well, the chairman has gotten on me a lot on this. It was actually one of my fancier ties. I was coming to the Commonwealth Club, never been here. But it has a bluish you over here, but I do apologize for that. And, but if any of you are interested, I can make you a great buy on burnt orange ties. I have 50 of them, and 10 cents on the dollar, and they're yours.
A more serious program about athletics is, can you comment on the role of athletics at UC? Apparently, the question sees some conflict between being a first-rate research university and a competitive Division I athletic program. Is that your experience? What do you see?
Well, you're talking to a man who graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, the home of the Fighting Quakers.
That's a high.
You know, when I went to Texas, there were more people in the marching band than I had ever seen in the stands at the University of Pennsylvania. You know, I think there can be some conflict. I think it's pretty under control at the University of California. I say that, you know, because, you know, I mean, I'm most familiar with Berkeley, but they've tried very hard to maintain a collegiate experience. I'm used to these mammoth stadiums of 100,000 people that hold 100,000 people in multiple tiers and, you know, and exercise rooms that go from here three blocks over and all. I think some of those excesses have been avoided. Davis has a football team. By the way, none of our football teams are doing well. Maybe that's because we haven't emphasized them enough. And then there's UCLA. But I think it's a problem. I do think it's a problem because, you know, they were talking about president salaries. If ask me wants to really get into it, take a look at some coaches' salaries. I mean, they're four or five times what the average president is paid, and that's a market, and you're in those leagues or not. But But I think we're pretty careful on the admissions side. I don't have the feeling they're out of control. I do think it is out of control elsewhere. You know, if one institution builds a Hall of Fame for the students to help recruit students, then, you know, some institution 100 miles an hour, 100 miles over, builds a bigger Hall of Fame, an even more expensive one. I think there's a sort of arms race. And unfortunately, colleges do not have an exemption from the antitrust laws like baseball. But a little price fixing might be in order here, with the blessing of the government.
There's some questions around the research role of the university, one of which is, can the university work more closely with business and industry to support research?
Sure. We do work closely with a lot of business, and there'll always be a tension. Look, if you're in business, your timeline is frequently shorter. You're looking for a product. You don't want to. It's hard to get a business to invest in pre-venture capital. It's just too dicey. You never know whether a real product will come out of it. The culture at universities, it's changing, but you know, it's basically disciplinary oriented. Someone is doing the research because they want to find out how something works, or maybe do basic research, and they're interested in impressing their colleagues in the same discipline. They may want to be asked to join the national academies or get a Nobel Prize or something like that. I mean, the incentive structure is very different within the culture of universities. But I think we can do a better job. And but the one thing, I think there's a lot of back and forth about whether we transfer technology promptly enough and whether we insist too much on our intellectual property rights. And maybe some of that's true and we ought to fix it. But by and large, private industry has turned basic research over to the universities because we're more efficient at it. Our people are better at it. We have an army of graduate students, and unfortunately we pay them near nothing, and they do a lot of the research. So it's quite to the contrary. Apparently business is coming to our doors to get the research done precisely because they find it much more difficult to do in their home environment. And there is no more Bell Labs, and Xerox PARC has passed from the scene, and Thomas Alva Edison is dead. And, you know, it is happening at universities, and there's good reason for that.
Another research question is related to how well the university protects its intellectual property rights in research. Do you get your fair deserts in this enterprise?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we're not primarily in the intellectual property income business. I think we ought to make a contextual decision. Sometimes we ought to just give it away and not preserve our rights. That's if it's better for the people of California or will spur additional advances. So, you know, I don't want to give anything away for free where it doesn't make sense, but sometimes we should. We are protecting it more, but the one thing you should know, I guess, as an audience is you really can't support your budgets with income from intellectual property. If you're bringing income of $25 to $50 million a year in income streams, you're in the top 15 or 20 universities in America. We have an $18 billion budget. It's nicer to have $25 or $50 million than not to have it, but it's not going to change the way you do business in terms of fees and appropriations. And by the way, most of these home runs are strange. Like the biggest home run of all time, do you have a guess, being someone in the education business?
No.
Gatorade is the big winner. I'm thinking of Cal-Aid. I just don't know what to put in it.
There's a couple of questions about the compatibility of weapons research with the university. I don't know that the university does weapons research, but if it does, is this an appropriate role for a public university?
Well, this is much debated by our faculty. And I mean, I guess broadly the answer is we shouldn't be doing weapons research. But, and this is where the arguments come in, we are involved in the Los Alamos National Lab, and there's a deteriorating, these weapons are deteriorating, and you can't sort of leave them in the desert and wait for someone to stumble across it. So now there's a program to sort of revamp these weapons and then from one side make them less volatile and less likely to result in some calamity or other. But there are many people out there who say, wait a minute, you really are in the business of making weapons and that's a debate that we're continually having at the University of California.
There's some questions on federal policies. What do you think is there going to be a change in focus with regard to higher education with the Obama administration? What do you see coming out in the way of regulations?
I think my guess is at the core, there may be more appropriations, but it'll be along the historic lines. I'd hope they'll put more money in Pell Grants and Stafford loans to ease access. You may see some movement there. I saw a position paper by then-Senator Obama and Senator Biden indicating that they would like to put more money into research for all the reasons I've talked about. So I suspect they'd like to do that. Whether they can afford to do it, I don't know. Now, whether they will bite on some new model like I was discussing in my speech of helping states construct facilities and all, that's much more conjectural. I don't know. But I think they'll be very strong on the core traditional programs. There may be more regulations. The Higher Education Act reauthorization was much more regulatory than its predecessors, and that might continue.
Do you see the federal government getting into the area of endowment, rate of spending on endowment? How endowment?
No, honestly, don't. Senator Grassley thought the payouts should. Well, he didn't really say this, but he wanted to examine the payouts from endowments. And I'll just speak for myself, not the University of California. I don't have any problem with a minimum endowment payout. It's not the end of my year. We do that on private foundations. We have rules. So, but I think we see in this economic downturn, there's a reason to limit the payouts if you want to preserve the endowments long term against inflation. But I do know the private universities went totally berserk at the suggestion, but I don't think it's going anywhere.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, where Mark Udoff, new president of the University of California, is discussing the challenges facing higher education. We have a question here from, I presume, a student who wants to know that the one student who is on the Board of Regents is apparently elected by the regents and not by students. And there's a question about whether or not you think it's important that the students have a direct representation on the Board of Regents.
Well, my general comment is I don't like to have any position on how my bosses are selected. You select the students by whatever method, and I will live with them. And I found having students, I've had it actually in all three institutions that I've headed, I thought worked fine. They're constructive, and sometimes they even liked them Regent Blum better than the adult regents. I thought they did pretty well. I don't have strong feelings. I think you could have democratized it some, and I actually think the ways that we do it are pretty conventional sometimes. I don't know if anyone with a student body elects person directly. Maybe the person asking the question does. I know of two methods, one where the board selects the person and the other where it goes to a gubernatorial nomination process similar to the other regents. I think that's a pretty good system. The states with the direct elections of regents have often had some significant difficulties when people are running for election on particular platforms. And if you think we do that and someone will represent your point of view, take my word for it, next year or in some other region of the state, there'll be someone elected that you think is representing a reprehensible point of view. So I wish the question asker Godspeed. I'm not going to get involved in this one way or another.
There's a couple of questions around the DREAM Act and the responsibility of higher education, public higher education, to undocumented individuals.
Well, our position, that's pretty clear. And we're appealing this recent ruling that we lost. We're taking it to the California Supreme Court. Our position is that we think scholarship aid should be made available to undocumented residents of California. And, we think it's a good public policy to offer educational opportunities. And most, maybe even all, these individuals will stay in our state. And we have an interest as a state in making allowing them to achieve their dreams and allowing them to be productive participants in our economy and democracy and so forth. So I'm for it. There are some legal obstacles to that, but I'm for it.
This is a question around the University of California's role as a cultural conservator. This is with regard to museums, rare book collections, art artifacts, and other important collections to the state of California and the responsibility of the university, and if you see it staying in this business.
Well, I think we will stay in this business. The Bancroft Library just reopened at Berkeley and has unbelievable collections, has this fabulous antique map collection. It has a collection of the papers from the founding of the state of California. And, I mean, it's a struggle. I want to be honest with you. It really is a struggle. We don't get enough appropriations for this, but this is where philanthropy is particularly important to us. And it's not perfect, but I would say, you know, we're very committed to this. I mean, if we don't safeguard these treasures, who will? And so we are committed, but it sometimes is a financial strain to get it done.
The University of California has approximately 1.5 million living alumni. There's a question about whether the Office of the President could coordinate alumni to assist the university in terms of advocacy, lobbying, and financial support.
Well, I think they can, and we've had some changing of the guard. I'm going to be reexamining this. I mean, again, the primary loyalty of an alumnus or an alumna is to that campus, and it may even be less than that. It may be to the engineering college or the law school or to the medical school or whatever. So I don't, you know, it's the allegiance is not directly to the system. It's to that campus and that school and so forth or a particular program. But I think we probably could do more, to be honest, with using electronic communication, just what the questioner said, more collaboration, coordination. I mean, we need to be more of a force in Sacramento, and we're not much of a force now. No one's afraid of losing an election over not supporting higher education. I see no fear in their eyes. They see fear in my eyes. And so I would like to think that our employees and our professors and our alumni could organize them better to say, you know, we vote and we care, and you just can't in some cavalier manner make changes at the University of California that adversely affect our students and faculty and employees.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question. And I have saved the best for last. And this is your prediction for the outcome of the big game.
The big game. Which big game? There are many big games. This total embarrassment. This is
the Stanford-Cal game.
Oh, the Stanford-Cal game. Well, Cal will triumph in that.
Thank you, Mark Udoff, President of the University of California. We also thank our audiences here on the radio. I'm Father Stephen Privet, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.